Gorgeous Reads in association with Henpicked, Wisdom of Women. A very warm welcome back to Radio Gorgeous to Allison Weir, author of many books, but we're here to talk about the second in your Six Tudor Queens series, Anne Boleyn, A King's Obsession. Welcome, Allison.
Hi, Donna.
So nice to see you again.
And you too. Thank you for inviting me.
We discussed Catherine of Aragon, the true queen, as we're going in order. As you're an historian, you're not going to jump about.
No.
And I felt that that was a very almost personal book for you.
It was, and I think there's perhaps something of me in Catherine. And, of course, it was much easier to write than the novel on Anne Boleyn because we have so many letters from Catherine in which she reveals her hopes, her passions, her fears, and there's an insight into her character. We don't have that for Anne Boleyn. In some way, she's unknowable. So for me, I mean, I do empathise a lot with Catherine and with her daughter Mary. And I think Catherine, if I had to choose, she would probably be my favourite of Henry's wives. I admire her for her principles, her integrity and her courage. I even named my daughter for her. So, yes, but Anne Boleyn, of course, is a very different character.
So what is available to us historically about Anne Boleyn?
On Anne Boleyn, well, I mean, have you got a spare week? But we have a few letters, and they don't give away very much. There's one pretty nasty one to Wolsey, who she didn't like and wanted to get rid of, and it's quite scathing. But mostly, they don't really give us many insights. And if we had her replies to Henry VIII's love letters, that would make such a difference, because we really don't know whether she reciprocated his love and what she really felt about him. Did she want was the king a means to the crown, or did she want the king as well as the crown?
Yes. And that is, and so because of that, one, she's become, I mean, because she was absolutely pivotal in English history.
Oh, she was.
You know.
We are living today in an England that Anne Boleyn helped to shape.
Yes.
And I'm talking about the Reformation here.
Yes, yes.
And that's probably, apart from the fact that she gave England arguably its greatest monarch, Elizabeth
I. Yes, yes.
But I think her legacy lies in the fact that years before the Reformation actually happened, she was getting Henry to read banned books. And if you read those books, they're more like tracts, if you read them, you've got... this is her vision. And this is what came to pass. This is the Reformation in microcosm.
Yes. And so you had to sort of make a literary decision.
Yes, I did. And it goes back to these sources, because the main source for Anne Boleyn is hostile. It's the imperial ambassador, Eustache Chapuis, and he's very controversial. But there's been a lot of work done recently on Chapuis, a lot of research. And he's very close to the events he writes about. He has very good contacts at court. For example, he's very friendly. He's a neighbour of Thomas Cromwell. So he knows a lot. And he also, as David Starkey says, he cites his sources. And we therefore know if a report is first-hand or fourth-hand, and who's saying it, or it's a servant of so-and-so, you know.
Isn't historian's dream.
Well, he is, actually. He's not a dream for those who are partisans of Anne Boleyn. And that, writing sympathetically about Anne Boleyn, you have this huge hump of Chapuis' evidence to get past. He didn't start out being so hostile to her. That gathered momentum. And I mean, she was, according to his, he's the source for her excessive, well, I say excessive, her cruelty to Catherine of Aragon and Mary when in the latter years, when Anne was queen. She felt insecure. She wanted them removed. And it seems her threats suggested by fair means or foul. She certainly wanted Henry to have them executed. Her own letters bear this out. We got one in particular that to the lady governess of Mary, saying, you know, give her a good clout or something like that for the cursed bastard she is.
Wow.
It's corroborative. I mean, it's very much in the same vein.
Well, and she's become for some people sort of a delicious villain, you know, sort of a...
I think she's become a very much a romanticised heroine. Yeah. The villain, the villainous sort of aspect is really gone out of fashion. Mm. And that was. I mean, she was seen as very... She became increasingly romanticised over the centuries. Wasn't until the 1880s when Paul Friedman published a two-volume biography. And he saw her as a scheming adventuress. It was a very new view. And it's almost a view for the modern age, but we in a slightly different context. A born political operator would be more the way people would see her now.
Well, yes, because you have to say, I think all the evidence points to the fact that she was an ambitious woman.
Oh, she was, this woman. Came from an ambitious family.
Yes, and I absolutely don't think there's any doubt.
No,
about
there isn't.
Because she could have stayed home.
She could have done. She could have said no to the king.
Yes.
And whether she did say no to the king is another matter.
Mm-hmm. Yes, matter for debate. But so you do paint a very, you know, a picture of her that makes sense.
Thank you. Because it was a challenge, as you said. And because how do you get over this? How do you write this book from this person's point of view and make her sympathetic when you don't, as a historian, find her a sympathetic character? And I talked to my editor here, Mary Evans, and said, I've got this real problem with this book. It's a huge challenge. And she said, if you can try to approach the subject from Anne's point of view and work out why she behaved as she did, then you can keep the reader with her. And when my agent read the book, he said it's a very sympathetic portrayal.
It is a sympathetic portrayal. The first thing you, when you meet her, is her father was extremely utilitarian, pragmatic. These children were there to advance him.
Yes.
Period.
Oh yes. I mean, when you think at the end, I mean, he was on the jury that condemned her supposed lovers. He was probably on the panel of peers who condemned her in the Tower. And he retained most of his place, his place at court, his offices. He lost Lord Privy Seal to Cromwell, but he was a survivor, and his priority was me.
Yeah, and it was not his wife.
His contemporaries said this of him.
Children, yeah.
His contemporaries said it of him. Obviously there was some concern. His wife was ill at the time of Anne and George's fall. He may have been worried about her. He may have thought he had to survive to look after her, but to preserve what was left of the family interest. But I don't know. I mean, evidence we have could suggest that they weren't that close.
Yes,
which
exactly.
I've tried to bring out here. Yes,
yes. Yes. So, I mean, that's the first thing we see. She's very close with her brother. She's very competitive with her sister.
Yes.
But you could see how this was bred in this family.
Yeah.
And it seemed very natural and understandable to me. And then she goes to the French courts. And there is actual evidence of that. I mean, you're not...
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Although what happens there, she's not mentioned in the year she's at the French court. It's only mentioned in retrospect that she was there. We don't have any evidence for what she was actually doing or where she was. And yet later testimony by Brantôme in The Lives of Gallant Ladies says that she's one of the stars of the court. Well, hello, where was she?
Yeah, it's very interesting.
So I spun a bit of a tale there.
Yes.
And I did quite a lot of research, too, on the movements of her mistress.
Yes, and what I found fascinating... was that you? There's, you know, when she does go to court in France, you know, she meets some very powerful, intelligent, thoughtful, thought-provoking.
Yes, she does.
Women.
I know. She's Margaret of Austria, first of all,
yes.
Before she goes into the court of Brussels,
yes.
and Marguerite of Navarre, later Marguerite of Navarre, Marguerite of Valois. And these two ladies were great proponents. They're what we would call early feminists.
Mm-hmm.
They are proponents of this great intellectual debate that was going on in Europe at that time, La Querelle des Femmes, which is basically the woman question. And all the arguments for feminism are in place at this time. That staggered me. And it wasn't my argument. It was because I'd actually floated a debate on Facebook and said, why are you all so fascinated by Anne Boleyn? Quite a few people came back and said, oh, because she's a feminist icon. And I'm thinking, no, that's totally anachronistic. And I said as much to Sarah Griswood, who wrote Game of Queens about women who ruled at that time. And she said, well, actually, no. She said, and I didn't know about this European perspective, this debate. I was studying Anne in very much an English context. And it opened my eyes completely. So I went away and did a lot of research, more research on that. And some of these conversations in the book between Marguerite and Anne, for example, and Margaret of Navarre, are based on actual quotations, you know, just lifted one after the other from these sources.
And even prior to them,
Christine de Pizan. Christine de
Pizan has... Yeah. Has written,
that's the Margaret of Austria passages, yes, yeah, because she had
Book
her works.
Of the City of Ladies.
Yes, she had her works in her library. She was given these tapestries at an event where Anne was present at Tournai, when Henry VIII was present too. And Anne would certainly have been imbued with this kind of culture.
Yes.
And so this is these are her formative years. When she comes to the English court, they say you would have taken her for a French woman born. It wasn't just the clothes and the mannerisms. It was these ideas. They're exotic. They're radical, you know.
Brazen.
Yes, absolutely. And it seems, although she wasn't an overt feminist, she didn't stick up for other women. My God, she acted like one in her own right.
Yes, well, she's sort of more like Margaret Thatcher.
Her confidence.
Power for her.
Her confidence shines forth. She didn't obviously see her sex as a barrier. Not until she became queen and biology defeated her.
Yes.
Because then she fell into the traditional mould and she couldn't get out because... You know, the constraints of the time.
That's another thing that occurred to me, that she was, in a sense, ensnared, entrapped by her own ambition. Because...
As it led to that dead end, basically.
Yes, exactly.
It did.
Because she could have left.
Well, where could a woman go in those days?
Exactly.
There weren't managerial positions, although some did effectively do that. But for her, she chose that route to power, the highest... I mean... She expected to wield that power. Certainly she did. But there's this dichotomy where during the courtship, she is Henry's mistress with mastery over him in the courtly sense. He's her servant. Get married, she's the wife under subjection to him, and he is her lord and master. And she can't make the transition. He does instantly. Yeah,
yes.
You can see the seeds of conflict. And that influence is still there. You can see it right almost up to the end where he's forsaking Jane Seymour and coming and summoning Anne to court so he can spend a saint's day with her. And, you know, and she's starting to regain her influence. And and Chapuis said, you know, that they'll get over it when they have a tiff. You know, they do. But, you know, Henry was getting increasingly, I think, jaded with her.
Yes.
And the evidence shows that.
Yes, and that her...
To satiety is the words that were used, yes.
Yeah.
And in a year before her execution, he was asking Cromwell to investigate the possibility of an annulment.
Wow.
Yes.
Which is amazing, since considering how much time, effort, lives were expended making this huge change.
Exactly.
That affects
exactly.
us to...
Yes, it does.
Day,
that's what I'm saying.
It's active.
We are still living in the England established by Henry VIII.
And I would posit that the Scottish question is in part the Catholic Protestant divide.
Oh, I think it probably is. It probably
and
is.
And I think that
there must
comes
be an
down,
element in it.
Yeah,
yes, there must be.
Comes down.
It must be, and it's because of the Reformation that a lot of religious troubles and divides have happened since.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If that hadn't happened, if Catherine of Aragon had given Henry a son, the monasteries might have gone or might have been scaled down because there was a dying movement. Not
and
socially.
There was money in them, their hills.
Well, yes, that was another thing.
Yes.
But cult, if you look, there's only two foundations in the 15th century. And so
they're
becoming...
Well,
it would have been a much slower death. I think, and they may have survived in some form or another.
Right.
Henry would not have fallen out with the church, so he wouldn't have touched them. He would have remained a good son of the church. But
Okay. So, but that was sort of another question that I wanted to ask you as an historian, as opposed to a literary author, was what would if it hadn't been Anne. Would he inevitably have divorced Catherine for someone in his desire
That's
for a son?
That's very hard to tell because you have three strands coming together.
Mm-hmm.
By 1524, it's known Catherine's not going to have any more children. He has got a male heir, he's got a daughter. In 1525, he meets Anne. He starts courting her. And a year later, just over a year later, we hear, I've been struck above a year by the dart of love. So he'd fallen in love with her. In the spring of 1527, when this is obviously gathering momentum, this affair, the French ambassador raises questions about the Princess Mary's legitimacy. And it's at this point Henry mind goes into overdrive. He starts talking about Leviticus and text in the Bible. His marriage is illicit, incestuous and unlawful. And then he applies for an annulment. So it's all coincidental. His concern with the succession, his desire for Anne, and his, you know, his concerns about his marriage. Is the one born of the other? Mm. Is marrying Anne an afterthought? It doesn't look like it.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. So it, we cannot tell. It used to be thought, I mean, I used to think that it used to be thought that he first was worried about his marriage in 1522, but that's not true. He himself said it was when the Bishop of Tarbes, the French ambassador, raised those questions in the spring of 1527.
Wow. Yes, it's amazing how much turned on that.
It did.
And then it was like, it was over in a second. You know, practically, you know, it was more years spent in the build-up of this marriage.
Oh, yes, it was. Oh, you absolutely, know, the marriage, then, yes. Then yeah, the marriage. 1,000 days, as the famous film or the play says. It was over very quickly. And Anne's tragedy was that she bore a healthy daughter, and then she had almost certainly had a full-term son. It was either born dead or died at birth the following year. It was kept hushed. A late miscarriage, which possibly a son the next year, and certainly a miscarriage of 15 and a half weeks of a son. She's pregnant for most of the way through it.
Yeah.
And she was becoming increasingly insecure. But Henry, at the same time, as he's losing interest in her, he's also determined not to lose face. He's going to show Europe he was right. It wasn't just Anne. Once he was set on his course with the Reformation and everything, he was determined to stick to it. Yes.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of modification. You know, he sort of backtracked a bit about, you know, about the monasteries. And initially, he may not have intended to dissolve them all. It was just the smaller houses that went first. Mm-hmm. When he was married to Jane Seymour, he actually refounded two that had been dissolved for her, for their souls.
Right.
So the suggestion is that he didn't actually, it wasn't a long-term aim at that time, it was afterwards, because you see the money wasn't coming in fast enough.
Well, so he does seem, I mean, you know, a bit of a quixotic character.
Oh, he was. He was unpredictable.
Yes.
And also, if you look at it, what came... Yeah, probably. I'm not going to say that. But probably, I mean, what came across when researching that book was how many threats Henry makes he doesn't carry out. A lot of him is bluster. And that's why I think people were totally shocked when he had the Nun of Kent and her associates executed in November 1534. It was the first blood shed for the great matter. Mm-hmm. And I think it was setting shockwaves through people because, my God, he's really doing it. You know, he's not just having a temper and stamping around and bluster and making threats. And so, I mean, you see it all the way through with what he's going to do with Catherine, what he's going to do with Mary. And he doesn't do it. And Anne's urging him, get on, you know, do it. And he doesn't. So, you see, I think a lot of it is bluster. A lot of it, you know, he could be quite gentle. He could be quite kind. He's a man of many, many contrasts. Very difficult man to know, I would imagine, because he was secretive anyway.
Yes, and that whole concept that she also very much bought into from her sort of coming of age in France, is the whole concept of courtly love.
Yes.
And that whole play.
Which underpins all relationships between men and women. Still does, even today, to an extent. Like a man might stand up or hold open a door, you know. It's going out of fashion, but, you know, I like it. But, that all comes from courtly love. The man is the servant, the woman is the mistress, and I'm not using that in a physical sense, because the word's been debased.
You know,
it didn't mean that. When he asked Anne to be his acknowledged mistress, he wasn't saying, well, you know, sleep with me and everyone will know about it. He was.
Yeah, no, but
she's the one he would pay addresses to. And often that was not expected to lead to anything more, because she was usually far above the suitor in rank, not in Anne's. And often she could be married. It was legitimate.
Yeah, it was a.
And this is what informed Anne's
display.
Anne's sort of love, or, you know, sort of banter with the men in her circle. And, of course, that went right against her.
I was going to say, she's paid the ultimate of being hoisted upon one's own petard.
Basically, yes, I know. It was her downfall, and it was believable because the state papers are just littered with slanders against her. What people believed, they thought she was promiscuous, her reputation was poor. So it was believable, credible.
Yeah. It's not like it's a mystery what happens at the end.
No, it isn't.
However, I have to tell you that I got... within sight of that moment while I was reading in bed in the morning before getting up. Yeah. Well, I was stuck in there I had to read all the way to the end. Oh, I was utterly gripped.
Oh, I'm so... Thank you very much. I'm glad you were gripped. I'm not going to say I'm glad you enjoyed it, because how could you enjoy it? It stayed with me for days. And I'd written it. It was grueling, because you have to be... You get in their head, you know, and you think, what the hell must it have been like? And I keep envisaging what it would have been like for her. And it's just the awful violence of that they did to her. Even though it was quick, it was bloody violent.
It was violent, and it was... It seemed... impossibly, it just seemed like an untenable situation to find yourself in.
It did. And if she was innocent, which I think the evidence strongly suggests she was, but of course I couldn't argue that in that book, but I think, you know, I mean, that's just dreadful, isn't it, to suffer like that. She lost everything. She lost her husband, her child, you know, and that, all her friends, not her title, because she died a queen. Because she'd been made queen by Act of Parliament, that hadn't been repealed. To come to that, her honour, her reputation, everything that mattered had gone. Everyone had fallen away.
Yeah. And it had been such a tremendous build-up and consolidation, and that it was built on such, I guess, apparently fragile.
It was, because basically all that stood between Anne and the rest of the world was the king's love. And once that went... What does she have? Nothing. She had no powerful friends like Catherine of Aragon. He always had that break with how he treated Catherine and Mary, because the Emperor was Catherine's nephew and Mary's cousin, and he'd stand up for his own. Henry thought they were on the brink of, you know, he was on the brink of war, and Chapuis fostered that, of course.
Yes.
And he wanted Catherine to incite the Emperor to war, and she wouldn't. With Anne, who would support her?
Yeah.
And that's why she went completely overboard when Chapuis made his, you know, the Spanish alliance is looming after Catherine's death. Chapuis finally bows to her in chapel, and she's over the moon. Oh, she's forget the French, basically. I'm this friend of Spain now. I think she thought Spain would be a friend to her. Hello, she was living in Clark Cuckoo Land.
Yeah, grasping at straws.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. And how well documented are sort of Anne's sort of love affairs, her prior...
Not very well documented.
Yeah.
We've got a very good account, though, of the one with Henry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland's son, because it comes from the pages of George Cavendish, who was a gentleman usher in Cardinal Wolsey's household and a witness. So he knew what was going on. But there are question marks, because it's the chronology of it could only have happened in 1523, and that's long before Henry is known to have fallen for Anne. His letters, we've got the evidence of his letters. And it's Cavendish writes, pardon me, that it's as if, you know, Henry instructs Wolsey to break this because he fancies Anne himself. It's very unlikely. What is likely is that this marriage was mooted for Percy with the daughter of the Earl of Shrewsbury, who's equal in rank, and he's not going to marry a knight's daughter, you know, and he can have the daughter of an earl. And the king had to approve all aristocratic marriages. He had an interest in them. So that's probably what happened.
Mm.
But Cavendish is writing from the viewpoint of 1550, so he's looking back and he's not remembering the chronology very clearly.
Right, right.
But, oh, sorry, I was going to say about the other... Thomas Wyatt, we know he loved her. It's very unlikely it was reciprocated. And it used to be thought there weren't many references in his poems, but Nicholas Shulman's done an amazing book called Graven in Diamonds. And she's analysed the poetry. She's found so much in there. It's a wonderfully convincing case.
And what... Because there was so much... I know you've done exhaustive amounts of research... but so what did you, because and there were new things when you were writing about Catherine, there was new documentation that had come to light. What new did you find out about
Anne?
It
was this feminist aspect.
Yes.
Was the most startling of it, you know, but there were other things too. I mean there is I've built a storyline there, perhaps I shouldn't say this because it gives it away too much, but there is in the indictment against her, it says that she said she had never loved the king in her heart. That actually rings true to me. Of all what was said in that indictment, it rings, because everything else would have come from that. If she'd loved the king, there couldn't have. If she'd obviously loved the king, that wouldn't have stood up.
Yeah.
And a woman who can play a man like that for several years and withdraw and go away. And the absences, separations were very long. I'm looking at them again. I was struck by that. Does she love him? Could you do that if you really loved someone? So it made me wonder. So that underpins that.
I was going to say, and the vociferous ness of her enemies. It yes. seems as if that was, you know, striving ambition. We don't love anything more than seeing that fall.
Yes, exactly. So, yes, so I that think she was seen to have got above herself. Yes. But then there's also the evidence that about her relations with her daughter, Elizabeth, who was only 2 years and 8 months old when her mother died. But Anne didn't see much of Elizabeth. Elizabeth's given her own household at 3 months. That's not to do with Anne. That's to do with the, you know, that's because that's what happened.
How it was done.
Yes,
yeah.
It was. But Anne is a very infrequent visitor. Mm. We find her buying all those little satin caps and things just before, shortly before she's arrested. There isn't very much else. She's very keen on forging a French marriage for her daughter, and that is the duty of a medieval queen to take. And Anne, we don't forget, we're just coming out of that medieval period. Anne broke the mould, but it's her duty as queen to interest herself in her children's marriages. And queens were always looking at the female side of things, you know. So, you know, her daughter would be her concern. Her son's wife would be her concern. We see her doing that. That's perfect. Okay, that's her ambition coming through. That's her blood. You know, she wants a good match. And her ambition is for her daughter, but she can't bond with her. That's how I see it. Well, we don't know that, but the evidence suggests it.
Well, and also the evidence of human nature suggests
yes,
it in
does.
The fact that her father acted the same with her.
It's another good argument. It's a very good argument. Didn't think of that.
Well done. Well, there you go.
Thank you.
It's one on me.
Thank you. You okay. Come around the next one.
So Anne is consigned to the past now. So yeah. You're on to Jane Seymour.
Finishing it this week.
Yeah.
I know.
And so why, I think it's called The Haunted Queen.
It is, yes.
Why is that?
Well, I wondered what it would be like to be Jane Seymour, as I'm doing with each of these queens, you know. But how would she feel, how would you feel, marrying a man 10 days after, 11 days after his wife had been beheaded? How would you feel? But actually, what's come across in that is not quite the obvious answer.
Oh.
If she's haunted, she's haunted by something she thinks is supernatural. Is it? But she's also haunted by guilt. She's haunted by thoughts of what happened to Anne. Was she... why should she... She has a guilty conscience. She wonders why. She's always wondering why. Was she not complicit? Was she instrumental? We certainly know that she agreed to... with her, all her, the coalition of allies and friends who gathered around her... They wanted her to sort of basically drip poison in the king's ear about Anne, say how suitable she was to be queen, how unpopular she was. And she did this quite willingly. And it put him in the frame of mind whereby he was, you know, it helped convince him he should be rid of Anne. But I don't think Jane Seymour, and no, very few other people, hardly any other people, ever envisaged that Anne would fall the way she did. They envisaged annulment, because that's what the king had talked about the year before.
Wow. Excellent. So
you're
just finishing
I've
that up.
I've got some really good some new evidence about her death.
Excellent. I can't wait.
I'm not going to say too much about that.
I can't wait. I have to tell you, I've been waiting with bated breath for this one.
Thank
to come
you
out.
So much.
So
thank
I'm
you.
Very much looking forward to
thank
Jane's
you.
Story.
Thank you so much, Donna.
And
thank you.
I think you're off gallivanting on your book.
Going to
tour.
Watford tonight.
Yes.
It started on Sunday, and it's going on all year, actually, on and off.
You are
the
one
next
of,
2 months are manic.
I was just saying, you're one of the hardest working novelists, historians, and...
I'm very lucky to be doing it, very privileged to be doing it. And that's,
I think
I really
that,
enjoy it.
I was going to say, do you, because you tirelessly meet and greet, but I think you exude such a joy of being able to have this as your job.
Lucky. Yeah, it was my dream come true from the age of 14. All I wanted to do was history, you know, to write it, to research it, and then to talk about it, which is great because, of course, I'm being let out because I'm sitting in front of a computer and it's nice to come out and talk to other people and see what they're saying about it, you know, and engage in the debate and reveal what new theories and, you know, findings of research. That's always exciting.
It is exciting. And what... Do you see it having actual relevance now, this history?
Yes, well, I mean, as we were saying earlier, I mean, obviously what Anne Boleyn's vision for the Reformation helped to shape the land we live in today. I think it's about women and power, which is becoming, it was increasingly, it's been debated. You know, it's in post-feminist society, gender studies, as they call them, have become very, very popular. But it's very interesting to look at these women in a different context. And sometimes, and I think the past can always teach us lessons about human nature, more about the actual history.
Alison Weir, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you so much, Donna.
This has been brought to you in association with Henpicked. For more information, go to henpicked.org.